The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Save big on everything for your next project now at Menards. Breathe easier with Best Air Allergen Air Filters. They trap larger airborne contaminants to keep allergens out of your home, and they last up to 90 days. Save big on all Best Air products at Menards and refresh your home today. View our entire selection of air filtration products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey everyone, happy New Year's Eve to all who are listening on the release day, and happy New Year to all that are listening to this later. I hope you have a much better 2026 than 2025. Just hope things improve all around for everyone. A quick little announcement. Today's episode is going to be a little different than normal. I shuttered the Patreon. I just didn't have near enough subscribers to justify the work, and that is okay. I understand that people don't want to pay for content. I just underestimated how much you don't want to pay. And again, that is fine. So in its short tenure, I did do some subscriber bonus episodes in a different format than the free version of the show. One of those episodes I'm sharing with you today. I really enjoyed making these, and I'm toying with the idea of incorporating this format into the main feed. This would not replace the regular episodes. Those will stay every 2 weeks until I need a break. But if we as a collective think this format has potential, maybe some episodes like this will pop up in addition to your regular Survivor interview episodes. If you're listening to this on Spotify, I put up a poll. If you're not, then you can go to my Instagram or the show's Instagram. That's at Lip to Tell Pod, or TikTok. I'm on there too. Yeah, and just let me know what you think. And also, please be nice. Please. Okay, I hope you enjoy this. Thanks, bye.
Okay, at the top, I gotta say that the Travis Tritt thing is actually a small part of this larger story, which is interesting because how could a plot to kill country music superstar Travis Tritt be a small part of the story? But I almost bet you will have forgotten about him by the time we get there. Okay, so we're in 1997. It's Your Love by Tim McGraw featuring Faith Hill, and Carrying Your Love With Me by George Strait, and No Songs by Travis Tritt are topping the country music charts. Darlene Stewart is finally realizing her dream of moving to Nashville, Tennessee to become a country western dancer and instructor. For reasons that I think will become clear, I have changed her name to give her a little privacy and distance from this story. Darlene grew up in Michigan and was excited to make her way on Broadway. Not the New York musical Broadway, obviously, but the honky-tonk one in Nashville. In January of 1999, Darlene met Parley Drew Hardman. His name is not changed, that's his real name, and no one else's will be for the rest of this story. Even those in witness protection. Darlene and Parley Drew met through dance, and Parley Drew offered to build Darlene a deck in exchange for more dance lessons. As we all know, country western dancing is the sexiest of all dancing, and the pair struck up a romance. Unfortunately, just 2 months into their relationship, Darlene's dad died, and she decided to move back to Michigan in May. They did the long distance thing, and in January of 2000, once they realized all the computers weren't going to explode, Parley Drew proposed to Darlene, and she said yes. So in August of 2000, they got married, and Darlene moved back to Tennessee to Murfreesboro, just south of Nashville. Darlene moved with the understanding that eventually, but on the sooner side of eventually, she and Parley Drew would move back to Michigan into her dad's old house. But it became pretty clear that Parley Drew really had no intention of moving to Michigan, and he started behaving very badly. Parley Drew's own daughter from his previous marriage said he became a different person after getting married. He was jealous of Darlene's dog, a black Cocker Spaniel named Maggie. And this is obviously worse than him not liking her dog, but Darlene said there was one incident where he grabbed her and threw her to the floor and, quote, had my hands above my head and his knee was across my neck. So in July of 2001, less than a year after they got married and 2.5 years into their relationship, Darlene filed for divorce and went back to Michigan. She continued to teach dance and raise Maggie the dog, and generally moved on from her relationship with Parley Drew. Within months of the divorce, Parley Drew got into another relationship, this time with a salon owner named Brenda, who was having a no-good, very rotten, kick-you-in-the-teeth-and-run-you-over-bad year. She had survived cancer and a heart attack and gone through a bad divorce where her son decided to go with his dad instead of her. She was very depressed and was contemplating suicide. But then she met Parley Drew through one of her hair clients, and she felt her lease on life was renewed. Brenda really went all in on this relationship, and not necessarily in a good way. She started missing work and was drinking a lot. Her friend of almost 20 years said she just seemed so desperate. But even though Parley Drew had moved on with Brenda, he still hadn't let go of Darlene because he's a small little man that couldn't stand that she left him. So through another one of Brenda's clients, Parley Drew met mobster Marvin Drosnick. A local loan shark and drug dealer who also had been or currently was in witness protection for testifying against the LaRocca crime family in Pennsylvania. Mobster Marvin had testified against the family in the 80s and then was put in witness protection, but also wasn't using his alias. Like, Marvin Drosnick was his real name, and that's what he was using in the streets. And, you know, obviously, he had gone back to a life of crime, being a loan shark and drug dealer. Parley Drew and Mobster Marvin met initially for a loan. But during their discussion, Parley Drew floated the idea of hiring a hitman to kill Darlene. And maybe Mobster Marvin might know someone that could take care of that for him. After many phone calls and meetings discussing having Darlene killed, Mobster Marvin told Parley Drew it would cost $20,000. Parley Drew didn't have $20,000, so they haggled and decided Parley Drew could afford the $2,000 it would cost to have Darlene's legs broken, thus ending her dance career, and to have her dog killed. now that they settled on the order, Mobster Marvin didn't want to get his own hands dirty. So he outsourced the violence to another mob guy in witness protection, Joe Rosselli. Rosselli worked for Mobster Marvin as a debt collector, so he was no stranger to roughing someone up. Rosselli was also in witness protection for testifying against the Gambino crime family. And though Rosselli was also back in a life of crime, what he wanted more than money was more police protection, because the Gambinos had found Rosselli's alias and already tried to kill him twice. And they knew his alias because Rosselli had been summoned back to New York courts for skipping his child support payments, because I guess testifying against the mob doesn't release you of your duties as a parent, and rightly so. So, in the court system, Roselli's real name and his witness protection alias were linked. So someone with access to the system saw Joe Rosselli, aka Joe Lucas, and said, "Hey, I know that guy. I think the Gambinos were looking for him." So if Rosselli had just paid his child support, there would have been no court, and he would have remained hidden. But since they saw his name in the court documents, the Gambinos were able to track him down, and they were mad. So Rosselli told the police about this murder plot, which at this point was really more of a beating plot, to hopefully get a little more protection from the Gambinos. So back to Parley Drew and his mobster crew, and now we're in the summer of 2002. The song Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue by Toby Keith is on every radio across America. To recap, Parley Drew has solicited mobster Marvin to beat up his ex-wife Arlene. In turn, mobster Marvin solicited Rosselli to do the actual beating up. Rosselli then went to the cops to get some protection from the crime family that was trying to murder him. Rosselli had no plans of ever actually beating up Darlene and was now working with police to gather evidence against Parley Drew and mobster Marvin for planning all this violence against Darlene. So Parley Drew and mobster Marvin met to further discuss details of this hit. I'm going to call it a hit because that's just what it's, I don't know what else to call just a beating instead of a murder. So we're just going to go with hit. Parley Drew gives mobster Marvin a dossier of information on Darlene. Her address, dance studio address, work schedule, a floor plan of her home, and a picture of Maggie, her dog. Mobster Marvin then gave this to Rosselli, who has no intention of carrying this out, but still went on a scouting trip to Michigan to verify if the information in the packet was accurate. And, meanwhile, Rosselli was also working with police, who have also alerted Darlene. Imagine hearing that your ex-husband, who is really just a blip in your timeline and that you haven't heard from in a year, wants you dead. So August 8th, 2002, Rosselli tells Parley Drew that he did the maiming or the beating, the hit, I guess, that we decided, that he beat up that lady, but he could only break one leg because Maggie, the dog, was causing too much of a ruckus. And this, again, did not happen. He did not beat her up. And Darlene was not attacked. That was a lie that Rosselli told. But also, I'm like, hell yeah, Maggie, protect Arlene and yourself. Anyway, Rosselli said he only broke one leg, but he like really messed up that one leg. He also gave Parley Drew a necklace that Darlene always wore as proof of the quote unquote attack. Darlene provided the necklace for the ruse. Parley Drew was bummed both legs weren't broken. To add insult to injury, literally, a few days after the fake attack, Parley Drew sent Darlene flowers with a note that said, "Sorry about your unfortunate incident." They, and I say they, because Brenda actually sent this on his behalf, which, you know, remember Brenda, Parley Drew's current actual girlfriend?
Well, she sent a letter anonymously that said things like, "Just when you thought it was safe to go back into the water."
Which I realize is a Jaws reference, but no one was in any water at any point, so this is an odd threat. It also said, "If you are ever capable again, I would recommend that you never step on a dance floor again in this area, or it could be your last dance." The words "again" and "last dance" were in all caps. It also included a CD with "You're As Cold As Ice" by Foreigner repeated 22 times. And if you're not familiar with that song, it goes a little something like this. Just kidding, I'm not going to sing it. But the lyrics are, "You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice our love. You never take advice. Someday, you'll pay the price. I know. I've seen it before. It happens all the time. You're closing the door. You leave the world behind. You're digging for gold. You're throwing away a fortune in feelings. But someday, you'll pay." I don't know if reading that out loud is more or less embarrassing than singing it, but here we are. But just imagine your boyfriend asks you to burn a CD and write a weird letter to his ex-wife. Like, "Sure, honey, let me get my stack of CDRs and fire up Kaza to help you harass a woman I've never met."
September 20th, 2002, a little more than a month after the fake attack, mobster Marvin was going to help Roselli into the cocaine business. Unfortunately for mobster Marvin, Roselli was again working with the police and was wearing a wire during the conversation where they discussed the cocaine. According to the Tennessean, the source, which is Roselli, arranged for Drasnak, that's mobster Marvin, to meet undercover vice agents at a hotel. According to court records, Drasnak, mobster Marvin, arranged to buy 5 kilograms of cocaine from the police. He was arrested, end quote. Faced with these charges, mobster Marvin rolled on Parley Drew. The police already knew and had evidence about the hit, but this gave them the opportunity to get a taped confession from Parley Drew. Mobster Marvin agreed to wear a wire to meet with Parley Drew and talk about other possible jobs. They met at a restaurant on September 23rd, 2002, and knocked around some ideas about actually killing Darlene one day and also taking out, say it with me, country music star Travis Tritt. No one could really nail down why Parley Drew would want him dead, but some sources say that Tritt had wronged a friend of Parley Drew's in some way. It was also suggested in an article that Parley Drew threw Tritt's name out there to impress mobster Marvin, which feels like a random choice to impress a guy that used to be in the mob, but I don't know, maybe Marvin really hated It's a Great Day to Be Alive. Sonny Koshy, who was the AUSA, the assistant U.S. attorney in charge of this case, said, "Our investigation showed that there is absolutely no indication that Travis Tritt ever did anything to merit anyone to want to try to kill him."
And Tritt said in a statement, "Needless to say, I was shocked to hear I was a target, especially when I have no idea who these people are. My family and I are concerned and are taking this potential threat seriously."
Time for a little Tritt break. So this is a bit of a non sequitur that has nothing really to do with the case other than, again, Travis Tritt, but it's one of my favorite little factoids that I found. Travis Tritt had a cabin in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Georgia, and on his very first night in this cabin, he woke up to sounds of 3 distinct voices in an unknown language. This would continue to happen regularly, including when he brought his girlfriend at the time, Teresa, up to the cabin. Imagine your new boyfriend brings you to a haunted cabin. Well, she was scared off because they got married and had children. But that same trip, where he first brings Teresa up to the cabin, they also saw footprints and imprints on their bed, like butt imprints, that belonged to neither of them.
The couple and their three children became scared to go to the cabin.
You would think they would sell it and pawn the ghosts off to some unsuspecting buyer, since they were afraid to go there. But instead, they, say it with me, waited until 2015 and got on a reality show with famed psychic medium Kim Russo. Kim believed it was the spirit of a hoodoo doctor that was murdered on the property, but said the spirit felt kindred to Travis Tritt and he shouldn't be afraid, and so everything was fine. End of trip break. Back to our mobsters. So, Mobster Marvin and Parley Drew are having a meeting to discuss murders and maimings, including Travis Tritt, but also not seriously Travis Tritt. And reminder, Mobster Marvin is wearing a wire. And the police are listening to every word. Mobster Marvin and Parley Drew conclude their little brainstorm, and in the parking lot, as they were leaving, Mobster Marvin gave the info packet on Darlene back to Parley Drew. Remember the one with her address and dance studio address and a photo of Maggie the dog, who is a hero, even though she actually didn't do anything. And just as Parley Drew was about to go on his merry way, the police emerged and he was arrested. So, flash forward to spring of 2003. This was just in the aftermath of Natalie Maines of the Chicks stating, "We're ashamed that the president of the United States is from Texas." This created a huge backlash, and certain fathers almost didn't let certain daughters attend the Chicks concert that they already had tickets for. But certain fathers didn't end up wasting the money, and certain daughters got to go. Anyway, Parley Drew was convicted of conspiracy to commit interstate stalking and murder for hire after Mobster Marvin and Roselli testified against him. Meanwhile, Brenda, remember Brenda, Parley Drew's still current girlfriend? Well, she not only stood by her man, but borrowed $175,000 from the bank to help with Parley Drew's legal fees.
$175,000.
While Parley Drew, who hasn't learned one thing from this experience, is waiting for his sentencing hearing, he approached Juan Canella, a fellow inmate. I have no background information on Juan Canella. You barely really have to remember his name. Parley Drew asked Juan if he knew anyone in the Gambino crime family, because Parley Drew can tell them where a certain mobster Marvin is. And in exchange for this information, Parley Drew would like the Gambinos to kill Darlene, Roselli, and the assistant U.S. attorney, Sonny Koshy, who prosecuted his case. Trying to get four people murdered is bad enough, but one of them is a federal employee. But Parley Drew thought he had a good chance at getting a retrial, and if the witnesses and the prosecutor are all dead, he had a good chance of getting out. Not suspicious at all. Juan, who I realize I just told you didn't have to remember his name, but he's the guy Parley Drew approached in jail to get a hitman. Juan told Parley Drew he knew a guy that could help him. Parley Drew met with Juan's guy to see if he would be willing to kill three people in exchange for information on Mobster Marvin. Parley Drew somehow knew Darlene, who was still living in Michigan, was seeing a new man, and told the hitman that if the new man died in the process of killing Darlene, that was A-OK with him. On November 7th, 2003, Parley Drew told Brenda, remember Brenda, he had a friend coming to visit, and he needed to be paid for his travel expenses. Apparently, it's easier to get reimbursed for travel expenses as a hitman than in my experience in corporate America. Parley Drew also asked Brenda to describe Darlene and AUSA Koshy to his friend. And while Brenda told him that she had pictures of them both, later in the conversation, she asked why she has to be involved and suggested to Parley Drew that this might all be a setup because Brenda has been paying attention. Parley Drew, in completely unearned confidence, told her to stop worrying. After they were done discussing, Parley Drew's friend
left the prison to go meet with Brenda and get reimbursed for his travel expenses. Brenda can still make a choice not to go. She can remove herself from Parley Drew's control. She does not have to be involved. She could say no. But Brenda goes to the meeting, gives the hitman the money and a picture of Mobster Marvin. I guess she forgot the photo of AUSA Koshi. And this exchange was the nail in her proverbial coffin. Brenda and the hitman go to part ways, and the cops swarm the scene, and Brenda is arrested. The hitman was an undercover FBI agent the whole time. Sunny Koshi said she's a grown woman. She didn't have to go through with it. She could have told him no at any time. To say that she was too weak or manipulated sort of demeans women. She made this decision based on her own motive, whatever that motive was, whether it was love or whatever. Parley Drew was convicted again and was sentenced to 20 years for the second plot, plus the 15 years he was already serving for the first one. Brenda, remember Brenda, pled guilty to conspiracy to commit a federal crime of violence, including the killing of an officer of the United States, and was sentenced to 6.5 years. She has since been released from prison. Parley Drew is still in federal prison with a projected release date of 2033. Darlene changed her name and moved from Michigan. I hope she's having a great life away from all this mess. I couldn't find any updates on Mobster Marvin or Roselli, so I hope they are both living honest lives somewhere and paying their child support. We can dare to dream. We'll be right back. But I do have another story for you.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
In the early hours of July 5th, 2002, officers Jacobs and Compton were called by an anonymous 911 caller about a potential fire in the front yard of 2051 Polly Drive in Billings, Montana. The officers were diverted to check out a casino alarm first that ended up being a false alarm, and then they headed to the house. When they got there, Jacobs turned on his body cam. It was around 2 a.m. and very dark, so only audio was really captured. There were no lights on in the house, and they saw a large hole had been made in the door. They looked through the hole and saw Richard Vernes, wearing chaps and a white thong, sitting on 53-year-old Luella Loga, holding a knife in one hand and Luella's hair in the other. Behind them, Pamela Vernes, Richard's wife, was beating 82-year-old Ella Loga, Luella's mom, with a walking stick. Pamela was wearing only a leopard print sarong. Both Pamela and Richard Vernes had feathers in their hair, and were covered in paint and blood. In the audio, an officer can be heard yelling, "Oh my God, she's killing her." Through the hole in the door, officers yelled at Richard to drop the knife. Richard came out of the house through the door hole, still holding the knife. Officers pepper sprayed him, and in an effort to evade capture, Richard threw the knife at them. It hit an officer, but didn't cut him. Richard tried running back into the house, but the cops caught him before he could make it back inside. Officers then, again, through the door hole, told Pamela to get on the ground. She came outside and was apprehended. With the Vernes subdued, officers went inside the house to find what one prosecutor would describe as one of the most gruesome crime scenes in recent history. So, how did we get here? Who are these people? And what is happening? First, some help with names. The mother and daughter in this story are Ella and Luella. So, for the purposes of clarity, I'm going to call Mom Mother Ella, and the daughter will just be Luella. Luella owned the property where these perplexing events happened and had rented the basement apartment to her friends, Pamela and Richard Vernes, in February of that year, which was 2002. They entered an oral agreement to pay $530 a month in rent and moved in on February 6th. At the time, Richard was on disability. He had kidney failure and was on dialysis, and received about $500 from Social Security per month. Pamela worked at an eye surgery and made about $600 a month. So, $530 was still pretty steep for them, and Pamela applied for rental assistance from the St. Vincent de Paul Society Office of Charitable Assistance. In February, Luella was paid $50 from the Joneses. In February, Luella was paid $50 from the Vernes and $300 from St. Vincent de Paul Society Office of Charitable Assistance, and in March, the Vernes paid $300. No rent was paid from the Vernes or the St. Vincent de Paul Society Office of Charitable Assistance in April, May, or June. Also, during their time living there, Luella said Pamela started making strange demands and accusations, though the article that mentioned this did not give details, which is a bummer. So Luella served the Vernes an eviction notice in June. Now, apparently in Montana and perhaps other places, if you don't pay your rent, the landlord only has to give you 3 days' notice to pay or leave. If after 3 days the renters neither pay nor leave, the landlord can sue the tenant for possession of the property, but the landlord cannot remove the tenant without a court order. The landlord also can't cut off utilities or change the locks without a court order. So Luella and the Vernes went to court July 3rd, a day and a half before the scene. In court, Pamela said their agreed-upon rent was $200 and asked for a $100,000 settlement against Luella. Unfortunately for Pamela, when she applied to the St. Vincent de Paul Society Office of Charitable Assistance, she listed the rent as $530. And even if the rent was $200 a month, they would still be $350 short. So the judge ordered the Vernes to pay $5,100 for back rent and penalties and gave them until July 8th to vacate the property. The next morning, July 4th, Luella woke up at 6 a.m. to loud music coming from the basement. As she was leaving around 8 a.m. to go to breakfast, Richard came out of his apartment and began shouting at her. He was swearing and making obscene gestures. When she got back, Luella decided now was the time to move Pamela's river rock collection from the backyard to scattered around the driveway. Pamela painted and sold these rocks, and they were precious to her. In the afternoon, Richard came pounding on Luella's door, demanding to speak to her about the river rocks. Mother Ella, who had decided to stay with her daughter because she didn't want to leave Luella alone with the Burns' downstairs, answered the door and said they had nothing to discuss. In response, Richard pulled down his pants, swore at her, and made a lewd suggestion. The reports, unfortunately, did not go into any more details about the suggestion. According to Richard, he just wanted to calmly talk to Luella. He said, "All I wanted to do was talk to her one-on-one and find out why she was doing all of this." Over the next several hours, Pamela and Richard got drunk. Richard was in debt, had kidney failure, and was now houseless. Pamela called 911 5 times because Richard was threatening suicide. The reports did not say how or if these calls were responded to. At some point in the evening, Richard's plan of suicide became a suicide pact. The Vernses took a combination of Xanax, for which they both had prescriptions, and other unidentified pills while drinking a good amount of alcohol. It was reported that both their Xanax prescriptions were so low that even if they took the whole bottle, they would still be under the highest dosage. At some point, Richard left a message on his own answering machine saying, "We've come to the end of our rope. Seems like every time that we try to do the right thing, it blows up in our face. So now we're gonna do the Cheyenne way. We're gonna go up there, take some scalps. We are not gonna kill anybody." Around 9 p.m., they dressed up in their costumes because of, as Richard's attorney would later say, their deep appreciation for American Indian spirituality. Richard said in his statement to the police, "That was my wife's idea. We were gonna get dressed up like Indians." They built a wood pile in the driveway and soaked it in gasoline, but they did not light it. At 1:30 a.m., Pamela called her friend Carol Darnielle. She told Carol that she and Richard were going to die by suicide, and she was calling to say goodbye. Carol, alarmed, called another friend, and together they went over to Pamela's apartment. Pamela answered the door in her leopard print sarong, covered in paint. Carol later testified that Pamela said, "Get out of here," and she was obviously out of her head. "So we left." But that doesn't mean Carol just washed her hands of the situation. They went to the nearest payphone and called 911. Back at the apartment, Richard and or Pamela cut computer cables to the house, thinking they were the phone line. Then Mother Ella was woken up by a large bang. She got up to see what the ruckus was, only to be confronted by Richard coming through a hole he had made in the front door with a 17.5-pound rock, presumably not one of Pamela's rocks. Luella came out of her bedroom and later testified that Richard had said, "You little bitch, I'm gonna kill you, but first you have to suffer." And Pamela said to Mother Ella, "I'm going to get you too." After police arrived and subdued Richard and Pamela, they could take in the gruesome scene. 3 large chunks of Luella's hair were found on the ground. The carpet was soaked with blood, and Luella was on the floor, cradling her mother in her arms. Dr. Jerry Hausinger, Hausinger, Dr. Dr. Jerry Hausinger, the trauma surgeon who treated Mother Ella in the hospital, said she needed more staples and stitches than anyone he had treated in his 20-year career. She had been stabbed or cut 25 to 30 times. But luckily, both she and Luella lived. As Pamela was being booked, she asked the officer why she was being charged with 2 counts of attempted murder. When he told her it was because Luella and Mother Ella didn't die, Pamela replied, "Well, she should have." Richard had been interviewed first around 6 a.m., and he confessed to attacking his landlady and gave a detailed statement. In that statement, Richard explicitly told a police officer they did this seeking revenge for the eviction. In the statement Pamela gave police, she described that she and Richard were on the, quote, warpath and wanted to scalp Luella and Mother Ella. She said, "Well, we're gonna get some wood and make a bonfire, and then we're gonna lift some scalps." Before their trials were even started, their respective lawyers filed motions to suppress their statements to the police. Richard's lawyer argued he was too drunk to understand his rights when he confessed to the crimes. His blood alcohol level was measured after the interview, around 7 a.m., roughly 5 hours after the attack, and was 0.11. I can't estimate how drunk this made him at the time of the attack, but consider that he was at 0.11 5 hours after he stopped drinking. Dr. Joseph Rich, a forensic psychiatrist, testified that Richard couldn't have consented to understanding his rights at that level of intoxication. The judge in Pamela's trial ruled that her statement could only be used as rebuttal evidence. So it couldn't be introduced by prosecutors as evidence, but they could basically say, that's not what she said in her statement. Pamela's trial was first, and her defense was basically that she snapped under all the pressure of being evicted and Richard saying he was going to die by suicide. Her lawyers also argued that, okay, yeah, Pamela did attack the two women, but it was certainly not attempted murder. Aggravated assault, maybe. Her defense also argued that she had what is called a paradoxical reaction to the Xanax she took. Xanax is an anti-anxiety medication. But they argued Pamela reacted differently, and instead of the medication mellowing her out, it made her aggressive. If this sounds made up, I don't disagree, but this is actually a thing that can happen. They don't know what causes this, they being, you know, doctors, and it happens in less than 1% of the population. Dr. Joseph Rich, the forensic psychiatrist from just a few minutes ago, testified that Pamela suffers from narcissism, obsessive and compulsive disorder, and histrionic disorder. But he also said this combination of personality disorders could not be used as a defense for what she did. Unfortunately for Pamela, the jury was unmoved by her defense and found her guilty of attempted murder and attempted murder by accountability, which was a new one for me. Basically, even though she only hurt Mother Ella, Pamela was being held responsible for what happened to Luella as well. Richard's trial was next and was scheduled for October 2003. Because the press coverage of Pamela's trial was so robust, his trial was moved from Billings to Butte, Montana. Richard's lawyer said, "This is the story of a man whose body had failed him, and the story of the two women who bailed on Rick Ferns at a crucial moment in his life." Now, you might be thinking the two women he's talking about are Luella and Mother Ella, but no. She's talking about Luella and Pamela. Because Pamela, you see, was responsible for convincing him to go into the suicide pact instead of getting him help. Never mind the 5-9-1-1 calls she made. And Pamela was the one who let him drink alcohol, even though his doctors told him it would be more powerful for dialysis patients. So you see, it was not Richard's fault at all. It was Pamela's. Just as in Pamela's trial, they argued that this wasn't attempted murder, but aggravated assault. Our resident forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Joseph Rich, who met with Richard 3 times, testified that Richard had told him he was blacked out when the attacks happened and doesn't remember them. Richard had also at one point been doing well on antidepressants, but went off them against medical advice. Unsurprisingly, his depression returned. Richard's mother, aunt, cousin, and a childhood friend testified that they had never known Richard to be violent. Luella and Mother Ella also testified. Luella said she still has pain in her head, and some of her hair hasn't grown back more than a year after the attack. Mother Ella said she can no longer drive and had lost some use of her left hand, which she had used to shield her pacemaker as Pamela attacked her. If Pamela had stabbed her pacemaker, she likely would have died. Richard was found guilty on all counts, except his attempted murder charge was reduced to aggravated assault for his attack on Luella. He was, however, found guilty of attempted deliberate homicide by accountability for Pamela's attack on Mother Ella. He was also found guilty of 2 counts of assaulting a police officer for throwing the knife at them before his arrest. Pamela was sentenced to 80 years in prison and said, "I regret what happened that night. If I could take it back, I would take it back in a heartbeat." While giving out her sentence, the judge said he was troubled by Pamela's plans to write a book called Murder Interrupted, which is how prosecutors described the incident. Her literary plans never came to fruition, though James Patterson did release a book called Murder Interrupted in 2018, which is based on a true story, just not this one. His book is about a cheating man who hires someone to kill his wife, sound familiar? But the hitman misses, and they turn on each other. Or that's at least what I gather it's about from the brief description on Goodreads. After his trial, Richard refused medical treatment for his kidney disease. Without dialysis, he would only live about 6 more months. He was sentenced to 80 years in prison and said at the hearing, "Now I want to be at peace." Richard Vernes died on June 17, 2005. Just 3 months after his sentencing. Pamela remains in prison. So that was it. That was our first Patreon bonus episode. Let me know in the chat if you liked it, if you didn't like it, but let me know that in a kind way. Let me know if you want to hear a different format, if you like this format of me just telling a story where no one dies, ideally. And yeah, I'm willing to accept feedback and suggestions. So I will see you over there. Thanks.
This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. You can follow the show on Instagram and TikTok at Live to Tell Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks.